fundamental question we were asking was, healthcare is an industry that helps a person live longer, get out of their sickness, disease, and all that. And why is it one of the most hated sectors that no consumers anywhere in the world like the healthcare that they get? Healthcare companies should be the most loved companies, but they are not.
How does a young company establish guardrails, right? Like, what do you have to maybe clarify on a fundamental basis when it comes to healthcare for the audience?
One of the fundamental problems of healthcare, not only in India but around
across
the
the
world,
world, yeah.
is misaligned incentives. The time period of realization of value. Yes, people are paying to stay healthy rather than to get intervention.
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jibraj, and today I have with me the co-founder and CEO of Tata 1mg and the co-founder of HealthCart. Thank you so much, Prashant, for joining me. Really delighted to be hosting you today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great to hear that, Prashant, and I think your story is a very interesting one considering how you started your journey of starting up, because it came at a point where entrepreneurship was not the, sexy choice, if I may, and there was not much awareness around it. And I want to understand that bit because you had the pleasure of going to Stanford Graduate School of Business. You graduated in 2007, if I'm not wrong.
That's right.
Then you were at McKinsey, and that probably gave you a head start and a level of awareness which was a touch above the rest. Talk to us about the foresight you had at that point. What prompted you to come back to India? Maybe early influences that led you to become the founder that you are today.
So I think when I went to the US, when I left for Stanford, I had pretty much no inclination or no appreciation of what a startup is and whether that is something that will be of interest to me. My applications also very much spoke about running large enterprises and corporate life and all the good stuff there. I used to work at Unilever, and I was very happy doing what I was doing there. So I think when I reached Stanford, that place, it was eye-opening. And I think just spending time with a lot of people, a lot of your peers who've been through the journey, who've done various kinds of startups or worked with various startups, there's something in the air in that part of the world. So entrepreneurship as a realistic endeavor, something that you want to spend your time with as a career option and all of that, became real only as I went through that program more and more. And it's the classes, the professors, the ecosystem, everything kind of makes you sit back and question that, what do I want to build? What is it that is interesting enough for me to spend my time and energy on? And I think most of the people do grapple with that at some point in time. The ecosystem there is just very conducive to it all coming together for you. So, however, when I graduated, I would say, very fascinated and deeply enamored and keen with the idea of entrepreneurship, but I had absolutely no clue what. However, the first thing I did was, the timing worked out very well. So I came back to India, worked with MapMyIndia, which was a startup it listed a few months back on the markets. But at that time, they were trying to figure out their B2C strategy and all that stuff. They had raised venture capital, and I worked with them to mainly get a sense of what it is to work in a startup. I'd never had that exposure before. Spent some time, got more convinced that, yeah, this is the environment that is really interesting. Having said that, I knew I wanted to do at some point something of my own. And however, I was also clear that I don't want it just for the sake of doing a startup. I needed to have a problem to solve, and I right now did not really have clear appreciation of what that could be. So went back to the US and spent a couple of years with McKinsey. And I think what that gave me was some in-depth perspective of the US healthcare system. Just built an appreciation of the contrast between two very different healthcare models and how the US model, while definitely not perfect, but the individual elements are very sophisticated. And they've gone through a process of being set up in a certain way that there's a lot of things, all those components by themselves are pretty interesting to see. In India, it's a lot of that sophistication was to come. And we believe that it will come with technology at the heart of it. So we started, and of course, that's when I met Samir, who came back with me and as co-founders. And we started our journey in the entrepreneurial health space. There was one more factor. I think what happened is 2007, 2008, around that time was the financial crisis in the US.
Yeah.
So working in the US was actually pretty depressing. Mm. The kind of work, the kind of opportunity, and all the projects we would get would be cost cutting and laying off and all that kind of stuff that we would do. Yeah. And it was a gloomy situation there when India was booming. Mm. India was active, happy zone of startups, and a bunch of my friends who were Americans actually relocated to India to start companies in India. Mm. And I was sitting there thinking, what am I doing whiling away my time here and just staying on because nobody is quitting in these times, no other reason to stay on. But when the opportunity is very much back home, that is the place to be, that is where the action is. And personally, I always knew I wanted to be back. It's home. So all those things kind of came together at the right time in the right way for me.
Yeah.
It was very important for me to also have a right co-founder. Otherwise, moving back is a big, challenging task. All of that kind of the world aligned to make it happen. So
yeah, got it. No, I think that's, everything falling into place to make it happen. And lovely to hear that. Before we go into, what that led to, which was Health Chakra, then Health Cart, and then 1MG, I'd love to understand the importance of this surrounding, high talent density surrounding, right? So consider an IIT Delhi, consider a Stanford GSB, consider a McKinsey. I'm sure these are all places where you've seen top-notch people surrounded alongside you. What does that do to you early in your journey, and how underrated or overrated is it, right? How can you design a life of like high talent density that gives you a certain level of awareness? Because what I can understand from you is that you had that awareness, that risk-taking ability, and then the decision-making to actually come and start something.
Yeah.
So if you can spend time there.
I think it does play a big role in shaping your perspectives. And again, we are if you look back at the time I was growing up or maturing in my early professional life, we did not have the benefit of social media and internet and the awareness it brings. So a lot of the thought processes, perspectives that we would develop would be based on the people we interact with.
Okay.
And for me, entrepreneurship did not exist because I never met entrepreneurs.
Mm.
Similarly, the possibility of raising capital and people willing to support you to do something. And I grew up in a family of professionals. Nobody ever in my extended family also ever ran any business. They're all doctors, engineers, architects, all kinds of professionals, zero business. And I had no appreciation of business because I never engaged with people from business. And I think when you get into an environment that has a high talent density, a diverse talent density, and people who are out there trying to achieve more and more, and people who are incredibly smart, you start thinking bigger. You start thinking that, okay, it's not about getting a job. It is not about moving up the corporate ranks. There is more. There's more that will excite you. And suddenly what you need to feel satisfied changes, evolves, and all of that stuff happens. So being in the right grouping is very, very important. And it's energizing. It just opens you up to, okay, there's a lot more you could be doing.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And it's great to have that echoed out loud, right? How perspective got shaped and goes to show how founders kind of go into their motivations to build companies. But coming to, of course, your journey with looking at the future of healthcare, because I mean, it's not very one-dimensional. Yeah. You started HealthCart with a mission, and then you realized very early on that content was working, and there was a different need in the market. So you spun off 1MG, which has now taken its own turn, and there was a company before that. What I'd love to gauge from you is, talk to us about the foresight you had at that point, right? How did you look at things in the clear manner that you did, or at least in foresight? I mean, in hindsight, it looks like you did.
Yeah.
And how it kind of played out, maybe give us a turn of events.
Yeah, no, a few things were consistent and many things evolved as we went along. So first thing that I fundamentally believed in, as I mentioned, was that the healthcare delivery system in the country will get organized and sophisticated around technology at its core.
Right.
And once that technology starts playing its role, the quality and type of healthcare that gets delivered will get better, because you will have data come into play, you'll have those predictive models come into play, healthcare will become personalized, predictive, preventative. For that, you need to have these data trends across large population sets. Those data trends will start becoming possible.
Right.
And so so that was fundamentally, that's one thing we believed in. The other thing that what we got wrong probably was the mechanism to build that platform. And we started with Health Chakra with the idea of that the healthcare ecosystem, wherever you look at, typically the doctor sits at the center. So let's digitize the clinic of the doctor. That's where we get all the data of the patients. And then from there, we engage with the patient, the pharma company, the insurance company, as had been done in many other countries many times over. And I think what we learned was that the market was very quickly shifting, and our premise that the doctor-centric healthcare model was fundamentally questioned as we spent more and more time, because, and I think the first year of the venture that did not work out was the most instructive. That's what taught us the most, with the biggest insight being that the world seems to be moving towards a much more patient-centric or consumer-centric model of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we decided we want to go direct to consumer rather than and try to build a model of healthcare, the same thing we wanted to do, but with the patient at the center. So it came as a learning after spending a year working in the clinics, working with patients, working with doctors and everyone, that the world is designed or is moving to a different model, and it will happen. Now, when we decided to shift to a consumer-oriented model or consumer-centric model, it's not the importance of doctors or healthcare providers goes down in any way. It's just that the healthcare system needs to, at the end of the day, work for the patient. So it needs to be designed in a certain way where the patient is your consumer. And like our technology platform, everything was designed for the clinic, with that being the center, but not designed for the patient per se. Mm-hmm. And when we talked to the people in the ecosystem, the wise old leaders of the industry at that point, everyone in I think based on good sense at that time, thought that we were being naive by that you guys just don't know how healthcare works. That is why you are thinking or dreaming it to be patient-centric. Mm. Because healthcare doesn't work this way.
Yeah.
Healthcare works in a certain way. And if you look at any market, it is either the provider-centric or the payer-centric, where you put insurance in the center. In the US, a lot of models are built with insurance as the primary reason, or the provider, and the patient is kind of one of the recipients of whatever gets done at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And we thought this is going to change. And coming with an FMCG background, started my career at Unilever, I thought it was very strange that something like customer-centric or patient-centric could be considered a novel idea. Mm-hmm. It sounds very basic. And I think 10, 12 years down the line, it's very heartening to see that now every healthcare provider, every healthcare company, every stakeholder talks about patient centricity as one of the key pillars on which they are building their future. Yeah. And so in some sense, at least we did feel that that's the way it should be from first mm-hmm. principles. That's the reason why there's a lot of angst. Like, fundamental question we were asking was, healthcare is an industry that helps a person live longer, get out of their sickness, disease, and all that. And why is it one of the most hated sectors that no yeah. consumers anywhere in the world like the healthcare that they get?
Yeah.
Healthcare companies should be the most loved companies, but they are not. Yeah. And what is missing? And what we thought was that it just needs to be putting the patient at the center and everything else will fall in place. And yeah. That was the naive or visionary, whatever one may want to call a view, but that was the view we took at that time, that maybe that's the way it will go.
Got it. And I think that worked out wonders and has
still work in progress.
industry standard. No, but I think that's a very fundamental point when looking at healthcare, patient centricity, because it's so overused in the consumer world, yet underused in the healthcare world. If I may just take another segue and understand this moral dilemma in healthcare, which is to say that hospitals are incentivized and they earn money by increasing the number of beds, which is to say that they increase the number of, you know, patients. Similarly, insurers have a different sort of workspace and incentives, and there are multiple stakeholders who almost seem differently aligned about the same objective. And considering that this can get a regulatory, you know, borderline space, this is highly regulated, how does a young company establish guardrails, right? Like, what do you have to maybe clarify on a fundamental basis when it comes to healthcare for the audience on a more general sense? And when it comes to regulations, multiple stakeholders, how do you think young companies can like navigate spaces like this, or what's a good mental model to think about a problem statement like this?
And I think what you have hit upon is one of the fundamental problems of healthcare, not only in India, but around the world
yeah.
is misaligned incentives.
Yeah.
And the other dimension being the time period of realization of value. So what is the right model is when it can be a life cycle based, outcomes based approach to healthcare. And yes, people are paying to stay healthy rather than to get interventions once things reach a certain point. Now, again, the US problem is the same, that the hospitals, the intermediary companies, disease management companies, pharmacies, everyone is optimizing their own model. No one puts the data layer across that entire system. Again, that is exactly what we believed. If you put it with the patient at the center, then you optimize for the patient, the experience and the cost and everything yeah. else that matters to the patient. Right now, the doctor is optimizing for, say, clinical quality. The hospital is optimizing for the business outcomes at the end of it. Pharma company wants to sell more drugs. There's that. They are all sophisticated players putting a lot of hard work and effort to optimize their own businesses.
Yeah.
Who is optimizing for the patient in the center, who is almost trained to accept opacity as the norm, that you don't need to know, this is too complex for you.
Yeah.
This is what is right for you, and we have decided for you. So now patients stopped liking it. They started asking questions,
yeah.
uncomfortable questions at times, and it causes stress in the ecosystem. Now, for a startup, it becomes particularly challenging when there's a additional layer of regulatory on top of that. So you are trying to change behaviors and mindsets in a industry that is fairly set in its way of working. But here's the good news, that at the end of the day, we were catching the right trend. And the trend was that the patients were asking the questions. And they were already seeking information, they were seeking opinions, and they were going all over Google, trying to read, is the right thing being done by me? Am I getting the right thing? And then they would go and talk to the doctors. Doctors would get irritated that you read whatever on Google, and you have the, if you want to be the doctor, then you be my guest. And it was something that was very apparent at that time. Now, when we started, we initially started with transparency around medicines, the basis for 1MG, which is we had made this drug database for doctors to do e-prescription. They never used it. And we had this database. Yeah. We thought, let's put it out in the public domain, how to use a medicine, side effects, interactions, price comparison, generics, everything about every medicine. We had manually gotten a team to sit and create that first digital database. And we put it out in the consumer domain, and the response was unbelievably fantastic. It went viral. People started sharing with each other, never take a medicine without reading on HealthCart Plus. WhatsApp messages got created and all of that. So we had the benefit that we, and it wasn't the most beautiful product. It was a very basic product. We had zero marketing money on that. It just went viral because it hit a nerve. Yeah. We caught that specific emotion that patients were going on in large numbers, that they need to know better about what is going on with their medicines, and they are not getting it enough information to give them confidence, and certainly around prices. So we did. We ended up with a situation where HealthCart Plus in 2014, early stages of app ecosystem in India, had around 1.5 million downloads, all organic, when the second largest health app probably was HealthCart, with 50,000 downloads, with all our marketing money and muscle behind it. And
this is in 2014?
2014, so still early days.
Oh, wow.
But without spending a penny on an app that was purely bringing transparency and information in health.
Yeah.
And we saw that, okay, the consumers are seeking, this is the pain point. And transparency is the first pain point. They want the system to work for them. Mm-hmm. Starting with transparency, then can we moved on to affordability, access, authenticity, and all those pain points of the user. Our journey has been about just understanding what the user's pain points are and solving for those, while building what we believe is the long-term model, which I mentioned is, it'll be integrated, it will be life cycle, preventative, healthcare, and data will play a big role in that. But to get that data, to get the consumer to engage with you, you have to solve their problems that are more immediate and real. So information gives transparency, and then e-pharmacy, e-diagnostics, e-consultations, we put those service lines together. Now, regulatory, I need to talk about. The part that is the most challenging for an entrepreneur in a regulated ecosystem is, this has a lot of benefits also, by the way. The challenge is that the regulator's job is to maintain status quo. Mm-hmm. And the innovator's job or desire is to disrupt and change the status quo.
Yeah.
So it causes a natural push and pull. So you have to engage very actively and spend a lot of time and energy on educating the system. Why what you are doing is beneficial for everybody involved, how it is in compliance, how it does not break any rules or laws, or how the rules need to evolve to serve the consumer at the end of the day better, etc., etc. So in our industry, we had to engage a lot sooner than many other sectors, because from the get-go, we wanted to make sure that we are fully compliant, and we are working with a regulator who understands our model. So we proactively went and sought progressive regulation that the sector probably needs to be governed in a proper way, and we would like to engage actively as an industry on that. And so it's been a long journey of engaging with the regulators and the government, but I think for a startup in any regulated sector, it's absolutely important.
Got it. I think a lot of fundamentally clear things about the system there. I love that. I think clarifies the healthcare ecosystem as a whole. What I'd love to also know is, you know, 1MG is also known to just become this factor of trust when it comes to healthcare, right? And this is very evident when you speak, when the other co-founder speaks, or, you know, whenever the leadership is talking about this. And of course, the partnership now with Tata goes lengths to fulfill that objective. As for somebody, you know, I'm sure each entrepreneur aspires to establish trust with their consumer at scale. Yeah. And this is probably the epitome of what it comes. I'm sure it is a work in progress. But if you can maybe outline some of the things that are very crucial and perhaps misunderstood about building trust for the consumer, I think that'll be very interesting to hear, Prashant.
So I think first thing, trust is not built through a marketing campaign. It can be reinforced, but it is not built just by marketing and communication. It is built by systems, processes, and fundamental values of the organization and how it engages with the customers that it does. So a lot of trust is just built. It is built over a period of time, and it takes a lot of doing everything with in the right way, with the right intent, and it can be lost with one misstep. Yeah. So having a very clear set of guardrails, you don't cross these red lines. Right. Come what may, we will not take certain types of shortcuts. Yeah. And that has to be ingrained in the organization, that this is the way we are going to operate. Whether it hurts business or benefits business in the short run is secondary. It's just not a way we would operate. And just to give you one simple example, medicines, where do you procure from? And 90% of the trust is not what you market as such, but from the very beginning, we were clear that we will not buy from the gray market. So there are a lot of gray markets, Bhagirath Place here, in Agra, there's a gray market, which has a lot of different channels through which medicines come and get mixed together, and you can easily get in a industry of 25 to 30% margins, you can get 15% extra margin if you are buying from the gray market.
Yeah.
Now, we were very clear from the beginning that we will not engage, we'll only engage with authorized distributors, and as we grew direct with pharma. Because for us, quality of what we are providing through our platform, even though at the end of the day, legally, the vendor who's selling it will be responsible if it is a marketplace platform, or if we are buying, of course, we have to be cognizant. But in our case, marketplace or not, we were very paranoid about where is the medicine coming from. And we would give up on those tempting additional margin points to make sure that we continue to provide things that we can stand behind. Now, not something that ever went into any of our marketing campaigns. And it is just that the entire team knows that we are not allowed to engage with certain kind of vendors, certain kind of dealers we will not work with. And so it's a brick by brick. Trust comes as a result of a compounding over a large... if you have the benefit to engage over a long period of time and you keep doing the right things, then it's the net compounding effect of that. And when you look back at or think about why you trust certain entities or institutions or doctors more than others, it's at the end of the day, it's a bunch of things in your experience with the that institution. And I think once the same thing, partnership with the Tata Group, it's an institution of over 150 years built on trust about a lot of little things that they have done, which kind of reinforce the same principle value. Anyone in the group, anyone associated with the group, everyone knows that we do business a certain way, that is the right way of doing business, and we do not compromise on core principles. And I think that goes a long way. And I learned a lot of that in my initial roles also. Unilever is a fantastic values-based organization. McKinsey is a fantastic values-based organization. And they have built leadership models based on principles. And once you, first of all, you have to believe in those principles, and then you have to set up your organization, the core people, they have to be believers. And operators to set up systems and processes that can scale it. That scaling is very important, and a big role in scaling in our organization was the extreme stability of the leadership team. So the top tier folks, the core group has been with us for a very, very long time, and they've built the organization, so it's their culture that gets reflected there.
Absolutely. I think these are, again, very crucial pointers to establishing trust. I think somebody on the podcast had mentioned that, you know, building a brand is about delivering on your promise time and again for almost an unnecessarily long period of time until the consumer knows that this is assured from the brand. And I think much of what you said just resonated to that tune. So lovely to know that. Coming to the partnership with Tata, right? Like, I'd love to understand that this mindset that entrepreneurs also have to have, where you have to let go in order to also, you know, achieve the larger mission of becoming the largest brand. Of course, by let go, I hear mean that, you know, a part of the company, you of course remain, continue to lead the company in its individuality and the brand. But in India, the ecosystem has not matured to a point where we've seen as many, you know, strategic exits or strategic partnerships. What do you have to say about A, the general mindset, and B, your personal and the organizational decision to look at the bigger picture of 50, 100 years and be like, we leverage the brand, the name, and build it out as a cohesive entity?
I think it's very person to person, and what you want to build and what do you want to spend your time and energy on and what drives you. And for some people, it is the what drives you is the full freedom to do what you want. And that largely was true in the initial years of building for me. But at a certain stage and time, what I learned really was driving me was I wanted to create something that will sustain and stay forever, and something that will be a meaningful healthcare company in the country that actually can change the way healthcare gets delivered and create models not only for India but probably around the world. And for that, I felt that this was absolutely the right thing to do for the company. That it was what it gave us the opportunity to do was build a truly remarkable, large, impactful healthcare business. Partner like Tata, what it gives you is you can actually take a long-term strategic view of things and keep building without having to worry about, otherwise, we, like most startups and in most sectors, it's not that big a problem. But in healthcare, I believe fundraise to fundraise and keeping optimizing for today, it's about GMV, tomorrow it is about unit economics, contribution margin, and tomorrow again it is growth and GMV and whatnot. Can be very distracting when you are building things for a very long term because the financial markets keep changing. But with a long-term strategic partner, you can at least take strategic views, long-term views, and put your head down and go build. And I think I was at a stage, and not only me, all the key players in the company, everyone was very, very committed to creating something that creates long-term impact, that really lasts. And for us, it was, and we certainly are very excited to build it out. So the partnership gave us a lot of positive opportunity, a lot of momentum. And I think, however, it always will be a personal decision at the end of the day. And if one reaches a certain stage of time, maturity, etc., then I think at some level you have to be much more dispassionate about first doing the right for the company, then figuring if there is a model that is also equally exciting for you. Because once the company has 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people, there are way too many people that are important. You're not the only one who matters, and you have to put them first. That is it the right thing you are doing by this entire organization? And in our case, it was, everything was aligned. So we were lucky in that way. So I would say it's something that one should walk into when one is ready, understand the trade-offs, but at the end of the day, the institution and the people who are working for it are more than just the founder. There are a lot of people there.
I can only imagine, and that's lovely to hear considering the constant emphasis of building this long-term mission-oriented company that becomes the largest health care company. I think that's very empowering to see even after, I think, a good time span of 7-8 years of building one MG and health card before. What I'd also love to understand is, at least from the outside, it looks like that startup culture, dynamics, fundamentals can be different even for a, you know, company of the size of one MG vis-a-vis a Tata, right? Has there been any sense of a difference in culture, difference in dynamics, integration?
So it's a journey, and I think it's a learning experience for both. I think, and however, both sides walked into it
fully
with a
aware.
Mature understanding of there are, it is going to be different, engaging, and that the learning and appreciation of what different models bring. I think it all depends on the spirit of the partnership more than the way things may or may not be working. Now, in this specific case, I'll tell you, for example, the way we would go about board meetings used to be very casual, very chit-chatty, and it's like all of us get together, discuss the business, and it would not go through the formal part of it was the
missing in
5 minute maximum we would spend on
compliance,
everything is compliant, everything is voted and all of that. We never had those specific governance requirements or way of working. But once you come to the Tata Group, and of course you've also grown to a stage, the governance, the systems, the process of running investor conversations, board conversations is very, very structured. It's very much like a public company, and you want to operate with the processes and standards of a public company even when you are a startup. Yeah. Startups typically have it much more casual. And I think so. Is it different? Yes. Is it not good? Actually, it's very good. So I would argue, though, that's something that it's good we are getting a flavor of how being grown up looks like.
Yeah, no, for sure. Again, I can only imagine, but good to know that, you know, these differences have not become a problem. It's only been a learning journey, and that's the best part. We've covered a bunch of ground when it comes to the models. I have two more aspects to understand. One of the other fascinating things is the offline expansion that is now happening at 1MG. And a bunch of it is also about, you know, you've gone on record to say that maybe 3-4% of the entire market is digital. So it's almost imperative that to build a meaningfully large company, you have to dominate offline channels as well. How has that journey been? What is the DNA required or transformation required to build out that muscle and scale in that manner?
So see, in healthcare specifically, the market is moving towards an omni-channel model. We want to be available wherever the customers are there and engaging with their healthcare. And two, three things that have happened. One is the other stakeholders that were earlier very small or peripheral have become material, such as corporates, insurance, hospitals were big always, but a bunch of these corporate health and wellness plays, insurance-led plays, did not exist. And now they have also become material. So we started engaging with them and expanding our reach to serve their customers. Then came the physical brick and mortar part of things. We started engaging with large hospital groups. And we are now running the supply chain and post-hospital home care delivery of medicines and lab tests typically for a bunch of these hospital partners, because that's something all hospitals are moving to a much more sustained relationship with their beneficiaries, patients. After the patient leaves the hospital, they lose every contact. Now we are trying to be that bridge as well. Then we've recently started experimenting with brick and mortar retail stores. So we've got some 50 in the in around 6-7 cities. And the idea is to create a 1MG offline, not just a pharmacy store, but pharmacy plus diagnostics and also consultations largely through telemedicine and technology. And we are experimenting with various formats, and the results do look pretty encouraging. So at the end of the day, yes, the consumer is interacting in various ways. They come through the direct on your digital platform. They come to you through insurance. They come through their company. Yeah. And they walk into a physical store.
Right.
We want to be capable to serve them in the manner that they prefer to be served and give them a truly omnichannel experience, whichever zone they come from. And our idea of setting up retail was that, yeah, we can create something differentiated, something meaningful in a physical setting also. How does one go about it is you keep building capability and keep learning. And I think some of these, and it's always a combination of hiring very strong first principles guys and very strong deep vertical specialized operators, and how they can come together, work together to create something so that you don't reinvent the wheels that are already there, but you don't create the same cart either.
Yeah. Got it. No, that's again encouraging to hear. I mean, with the different phases that the company has gone through, this must be a different one as well. And this is how, you know, the transformation of a meaningfully large company looks like. So lovely to hear. And I hope that brings ambition to whoever is listening. The other bit that you've also constantly mentioned is the talent aspect, be it the lack of attrition, be it how you've managed to attract top tier talent, in fact, not top tier talent that just works. How do you reckon going about this, especially when a lot of this only in hindsight makes sense? I'm guessing in when you were building it out, it was not as evident as it is now. So what were your, you know, ways to attract great talent, retain them, build up the company?
So the early team is actually people who come and work with you purely on faith. Yeah. And they are the believers. They are the people who inherently are excited about what is getting built. And finding that right core team initially up front, I think, is the single most important thing in the talent journey. And we used to have a professor at Stanford. His famous quote used to be that A's hire A's and B's hire C's. So if you hire a B, then B, you can rest assured that you will have an organization of C's. Because a person who's B will feel threatened by better people than him or her. Mm. A person who's A gets energized by having people of equal or more capability around them, because they are very secure about their own capabilities. And And I think having the initial key folks who are strong A performers, not only in skills and capabilities, but also in terms of values, that is absolutely critical, because that is, they are the ones who build the rest of the organization. And you may hire first 10, 20, 50 people, and after that, it percolates. And if you make a mistake in the people that you bring on board, you can be assured that it'll only go downhill. So you have to really put in the effort to bring in the A's who will then build up the rest of your organization. The other part is it somehow has really worked for us that we are a mission-based organization, and the work truly, people feel good about the impact that they themselves are creating and seeing happen. And especially the team that went through the COVID experience and what we did during that, folks stood up and delivered when it mattered. All of that, I think, at the end of the day, attaches a person to the organization or the role that they do, that they find some meaning besides the economic benefit. And I think there are always other players out there who will be offering more money, who will be offering more senior titles and all that kind of stuff. And we had our fair share of challenges, during the post-COVID, there was such a influx of capital into digital health, and so many startups got funded so quickly and so well. And a lot of them, once you have a lot of money and an early stage organization, the first thing your board will tell you is build a leadership team. And where do you build a leadership team? You go and pick from whoever are the best companies in your industry. And in our sector, there was a handful of companies to choose from. So we were a favorite target for most of these, and our people were approached pretty actively. And most of them chose to stay and believe that there's a better future building what they are building here than having to move. So some things have worked.
Lovely. You just spoke about A players, right? Can you quickly define or just help us envision what A players look like and how you identify them?
So I think what I see is that they don't need to be, they don't accept boundaries to their role. They create their own roles. They expand their own influence. They don't look at things from a myopic thing of this is my function's requirement, that they think this is the right thing to do. And it's a very inherent kind of a quality that we should be doing this because it is the right thing to do. It doesn't matter which department's credit it is or this or that. And they are very focused on the bigger picture, and they are looking for the building for the long term. And those players, I think, are certainly very capable of building good teams. They are able to inspire people to join them for non-monetary reasons as well. So it's and over a period of time, you kind of do your own kind of pattern recognition that these are the kind of people who will work, these are the kind of people who will not. But A also has to be in context of your organization. In our organization, it has to be a very collaborative person who can work with very different functions, very different mindsets, and still they are very much committed to making things happen and don't accept boundaries. And so I think those are the kind of folks.
Got it. I love that definition. One other thing that really stands out, Prashant, and we can end with a couple of personal questions. This is a series of similar questions that I ask each founder. But one that's special to you, at least from afar, is the fact that staying course to your mission till you see it through is a quality that is not only admirable, it's also aspirational in nature. It's been 13 years, you've done course correction, you've had the, you know, affection and audacity to also take another route when the course demanded it. So from health card to 1MG. It's now been 13 years. Do you have learnings that you'd like to share in terms of how do you just stay true to the mission, keep moving north and just keep going?
No, I think you have to, as I said, the ambition was fairly audacious, and it's a journey that you yourself know is only you're just still in a very early stage. It's work in progress. So as long as you can see continued excitement around building something that needs to be built, and you feel you are the right person to do that, and you are able to continually move forward on that, and I think you just find various ways to keep yourself excited and motivated, because the good thing about the startup world is some things, you can try out a lot of experiments, you can see what is working, you can keep learning. So there's no stagnation of mind or role or anything. And I think there's enough challenging work and exciting work that is now. So I always look at what can happen next, and at the end, the next phase looks super exciting right now. Yeah. And just by chance, so has been the case over the last minute. So it's some, at the end of the day, how one is wired, I guess. But what I see right now is in healthcare, what have we built so far is actually just the plumbing blocks, the basic infrastructure, the core layers of the plumbing, which is e-pharmacy, e-diagnostics, e-consultation, digital information, all of that. Next phase is when it all comes together. You bring it together. That's when the data starts coming into play. That's where AI, ML, IoT, all the good stuff, it all comes together. Life cycle models, disease management, healthcare changes from being curative to health management. All of that stuff sounds very exciting. So I think I see that it needs to be built, and I feel as of now, I have the energy and desire to continue. Doing that. But when I find someone I feel is better positioned to do that, I'll be happy to hand it over as well. So it's not, but right now I think it's just very, very exciting for me to hang in there and keep building.
Got it. Out of curiosity, is this mission orientation, long-term thinking, the default mode? Or do you also have to condition yourself, discipline yourself to be like, okay, this is what we're working towards?
No, it's a default mode for me at least. And I think that's, I don't know if it can be cultivated or I don't know. I think I am built this way, that I look at things like that. And I'm not sure whether it is necessary. To be honest, I think there's a very clinical get the job done mode also, and many founders build to monetize, to sell and move on, and that's fine. I think everybody is wired in a certain way. Forcing them to have a mission mode will not work for them. I don't think it gets cultivated. Right. It's just, I happen to be this way, so I happen to be in the sector I am, doing what I am. So.
Yeah. No, of course, to each their own, but I think it was only fair to ask if it can be, you know, inorganically induced as well.
I don't know.
Fair enough. No, food for thought, perhaps. For the second last bit, I'd love to understand, you know, we can measure and quantitatively look at the growth of 1MG, but it's very difficult to measure the founder's growth. And very often, that's very intangible in nature. If you had to put into words how maybe you have scaled through this journey, like what is the difference in the Prashant who started, you know, Health Cart vis-a-vis looking at the next 10 years, who you are today, if you can maybe put it into words to just help us measure the growth of a founder going through this journey, I think that'll be fabulous.
Yeah, so I think as a person, you evolve quite a bit. You, in the early stages of the journey, the journey is about a lot of extreme highs and lows all the time.
Yeah.
In the early stages of the journey, you react a lot more to both the highs and the lows. You feel you are the champion and you feel you're dead. And after a while, you take that a little more in your stride. It's all a part of a longer journey, and you start also recognizing how big a role the factors that are way beyond you are playing in making the success. So you become a lot more grateful to the world and to good fortune and luck that came your way, that you survived while a lot of other good folks couldn't.
Mm.
And I think so you just become a little more grounded, calm, as maybe it's more the age thing or the experience thing, but and also you start seeing a lot of patterns because you've seen a lot of them very, very closely. You maybe it also makes you a little cynical because during early days of Health Cart, every idea I just wanted to go and try out. Yeah. Now half of them I myself reject that this won't happen. So yeah. You kind of filter out a lot of things that would excite you. Mm-hmm. And at some level, the quality of your filter determines how you scale and how good you are at the end of the day. And your focus shifts a lot more, at least my focus has shifted a lot more to being the enabler than being the player.
Hmm.
So if you have the benefit of looking back 5-10 years of building, the most heartening and enjoyable part is actually to see people scale.
Yeah.
That who you hired then and what that person has become now.
Yeah.
And then you look back that, okay, probably you are better off just spending energy trying to make your people scale. Just clearing the what distracts them so that they can go and be successful. So in the early phase, you just want to do everything yourself. You want to just, this is the problem, I'll run there, solve it there, I'll run and solve it, I'll do everything, and I have the energy and the desire. And it's as you mature, you learn to let go. You learn to trust your teams and you also learn to be okay by letting your teams make mistakes you are 100% sure they are going to make. But till they make those mistakes, they won't learn. So you just kind of chill out a little bit and you see the picture in a little detached manner. And and I guess it's different for everyone, but.
Yeah, I love that. I think a lot of refreshing learnings. I'll probably catch on to that being a enabler, not the player sort of learning. And that's definitely meaningful. Goes to show the experience and wisdom that's been gathered over the years. I think that summarizes most of the learnings, but maybe for a stereotypical end, right? I mean, one of the things that I want to do on the podcast and I mention out loud is not to make entrepreneurship seem ambitious, to, you know, reflect and share via experts like you who've been through the journey, the truth about entrepreneurship. So if you had to, I mean, I don't want to be dramatic, but considering the challenges, the roughs, the downs, what are things nobody will tell us about the journey, but you can? Any truths of the kind?
I think it's, you are likely to fail. And a lot of things, everything has to fall in place for you to, and you need to do whatever is whatever you can do to survive and live to fight another day. I think it's very, very important through this journey also to start as soon as you can, figuring out what are the variables you can control, what are the variables you cannot control.
Mm.
And spend all your energy on what you can control and forget about what you cannot. You cannot control if other players are getting funded, if the market is going up or down or not. You can probably control your team, your sales, your energy goes in things that are under your ambit. You cannot control if there will be COVID or not, or no, things that you cannot control. You don't bother or obsess about those things. And typically, early founders, the equation is often opposite, that they obsess about things that are completely out of their control. And as a result, you have less energy and time to spend on things that you can. So the journey will be hard. It will be brutal. It will be... and you will only hear the good news of everyone else, that everyone else is succeeding and you are the only one going through a struggle. Yeah. But the reality is, every single person, they go through good phases and they go through struggles. Anyone who has been in the game 5, 10, 15 years has died almost many, many times. You get this close to death so many times. You only hear about stories, like people like me are coming and talking and giving gyan on the podcast because we are the survivors. Yeah. Now, there are a lot of people who actually tried their best, it did not happen, and that's the majority, unfortunately. Yeah. So as a entrepreneur, you have to be really ready for it, for the right reasons. Yeah. It's the what you see on print and TV and all is the filter of what success of that looks like. So that's the top 1, 2, 3, 5%, but the rest of it is a grind. And for even for these 1, 3, 5%, it is a grind, that it's just that they survived through that. So most people will, who will be raising money or building companies in this market will have a better sense of that very shortly than those who raised money when the world looked very rosy and capital was in abundance. But now it will be a challenging time.
Got it. I love how you speak about the struggles with a smile on your face. This has been an absolute pleasure, Prashant. I think we've covered a lot of ground, from like understanding fundamentals of healthcare to what 1MG is doing, how you've established trust, patient centricity, and what it means to build a meaningfully large business and continue on this journey. Thank you so very much for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me.